This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Hello again. This is Don Nolan, not Steve Shoemaker. Steve is out of town at the moment, and I am sitting in his place. I am a professor of philosophy and religious studies at Parkland. And today we're very pleased to have a guest who's been on the program, how many times did you say? Four or five times?
Four or five, yes.
Four or five. Father Monsignor Stuart W. Sweatland. He is the chaplain at St. John's Catholic Chapel. He is also the director of the Newman Foundation at the University of Illinois and director of campus ministry of the Diocese of Peoria. You must be a very busy fellow.
They keep us busy.
Thank you for coming.
It's good to be here.
Our general topic is the new pope. What is it, 5 weeks in? Is that right?
Right. We're just entering the sixth. Right?
Father Ratzinger, or Bishop Ratzinger, now known as Pope Benedict the 16th. Is that right?
That's correct.
We're going to talk a little bit about his impact on the church, a little bit about him and the future of the Catholic Church under his aegis. This is a call-in show. As we proceed through the next hour, feel free to call in and put any questions that you care to our guest. Our number is 333-9455, or you can call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Once again, that's locally 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Well, why don't we start off, if we could, Father Sweatland, with a little bit of what it is that you do and how you got associated with the Newman Foundation.
I'm a convert to the Catholic faith. Actually, came into Catholicism at a Newman Center at Oxford University. So most of my priesthood has been spent in service at Newman Foundations or centers. I was 2 years at Bradley University at the Newman Center there before coming here in 1997. I'm currently the director of the Newman Foundation, which our goal, our job, is to minister to the Catholic students, faculty, and staff of the university, and to be a presence on campus to witness to the Catholic faith. I also have a side job of being an adjunct professor in the religious studies program, where I offer courses on Catholic social teaching, which my doctoral work is in, and also in the ethics of war and peace, mm-hmm. An area as an ex-military officer and as a Catholic. Partly my doctoral thesis touched on these areas as well. So it's areas that I try to provide to the university as a faculty member.
So hopefully at some point in the program we'll touch on the contemporary war.
If you wish.
Well, our topic, as we've said, is the election of our new pope, Pope Benedict the 16th. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your association with him. I understand that you worked with him in the past, and particularly at the Vatican.
I was very fortunate when I was a young deacon on my way to ordination as a priest to be asked to work on the catechism project that was then going on. In 1985, some American bishops at a synod of bishops that was in the 20th anniversary of Vatican II, mm-hmm. asked for there to be a catechism that would be updated in light of the teachings of the Second Vatican Council, which had happened from 1962 to 65. So between 85 and 90, there had been a draft put together of a catechism, and then that was sent to all the bishops of the world. Each bishop was to ask for commentaries from theologians and from their own staffs. And then Bishop Myers of Peoria asked me to comment, especially as a convert, what I thought of the draft of the catechism. Well, to make a long story short, I got to work with some theologians here in America, and we put together a commentary on the first draft. And when it was needed in Rome for there to be someone who had a primary English language, who was primarily an English speaker, to deal with all the commentaries that were coming in from throughout the world, I was asked to go over for the summer of 1990 to work with the editor of the Catechism, who was then Father von Schomburg, who's now the Cardinal Archbishop of Vienna. So I was his administrative assistant working with the English language commentary, and his boss was Cardinal Ratzinger. So we worked fairly closely because there was a group of about 30 working on the on the project. And what Cardinal Ratzinger would do is make sure that he rotated each meal to be with four or five of us. So we got several times to sit together and, and talk together. And I got to see him firsthand how he operated and how he thought.
At that time, was he, I'm not sure what the official title of his position, but he was the prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine and Faith?
CDF? Right. And that's what that's whose auspices the drafting of the catechism fell under. So he was overall in charge of the project. He had taken that over a few years earlier in the early 80s. And as the prefect, he had to bring the project together.
Mm-hmm. What is that office?
That office is the office in charge of the doctrinal teaching of the church. It's to ensure that the faith is handed on to each era, to every age, whole and entire. So it, in one sense, is like a watchdog. Its job is to look at the theology being presented as Catholic theology, to ensure, if you will, truth in advertising, that what is being presented as Catholic theology is, in fact, Catholic theology. Its other job is to deal with disputed questions. Uh-huh. Often people will put in what's called a dubium, where there's a question of that is dubious what the answer should be. And it's up to the congregation to propose an answer, which can either be done by the congregation itself, or if the congregation feels it's important enough and the Holy Father agrees, the Holy Father then can address it in our most formal teaching next to an infallible statement, which is called an encyclical.
Who is on the congregation?
The congregation itself is the prefect, but then there's a group of 12 cardinals that form the actual congregation. The prefect runs the day-to-day operation and is in charge of the staff and the work, but the congregation itself is a group of 12 cardinals who are appointed by the Holy Father to that.
And he was the prefect for
how
long?
He was the prefect from the early 80s until he was elected pope, so almost 25 years, yes.
I've heard it said that this is the second most influential or powerful position in the Vatican.
It depends on how you look at it. Technically, it's the third because the Secretary of State, which is in charge of running the day-to-day operations of the Vatican, would have to be considered more important from a bureaucratic point of view. Mm-hmm. But because it deals with the teaching of the faith, the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith is often considered, the person who has that role is often considered the second most powerful person.
And does Pope Benedict appoint that person?
He did. He just appointed his replacement. He picked an American, Archbishop Leveda, who was had been working on the congregation as a priest way back when in the 80s. He was also on the Catechism Project. I met him there. And he is currently was the Archbishop of San Francisco.
I see. Yeah. Well, the Pope Benedict has achieved quite. I'm not quite sure how to put it. Let me just simply put it neutrally: notoriety in the press on both the positive and negative. There's an awful lot of positive response. I understand within the church itself. Perhaps more negative responses within the North American church. Is that correct?
I think that's accurate. There's been a great deal written about the Pope. Probably more has been written in English than in the other languages. So that's probably accurate.
Why the negative reaction? And then I'll ask you why the positive reaction.
Right. Well, the negative reaction, I think, has to do a lot with his former job as the prefect for the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith. He did have to be a disciplinarian when it came to theological expression. Mm-hmm. And America being what America is, or North America being what North America is, we put a great deal of emphasis on freedom, including freedom of expression, which, of course, is a Catholic value as well. But when it comes to theological expression, because it's very important that we don't lead the little ones astray, as Scripture says, there has to be someone who's in charge of actually checking our theology to make sure it's proclaiming the faith and not in any way distorting it or making it more difficult to understand. So he did have to discipline some theologians because of what was perceived as a drift or a lack of clarity in some of their writings. And anytime you're a disciplinarian, sometimes that leads to people thinking poorly of you. And I think to a large extent, his role as disciplinarian was the one that was emphasized in America, even though that's probably a little unfair both to the prefect's job and to the person.
There's a lot of folks who worry, wringing their hands about purges within the church. Others respond that the office makes the man and the size of the office will surprise us when we see Pope Benedict actually at work. What is your view of that?
Well, first, having known him personally, I would say that we do not have to worry about any purges, for sure. Mm-hmm. He's an extraordinarily prayerful man, a great theologian in his own right. Probably the only prefect for the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith who continued to be a theologian while he served in that role, publishing many scholarly articles and books. He takes theology and the search for the truth very seriously. Proof of this is even someone who disagrees with him heavily, someone he had to be involved in disciplining, a good friend of his, Hans Kuhn, continues to speak positively of their relationship as friends and as people who are dedicated to pursuing the truth, even though they recognize they disagree about almost everything.
What was the disagreement?
Specifically on the book that Kuhn put out, Infallibility? Which had to do with the role of the papal office and the teaching authority of the Bishop of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
What you'll see, I think, in Cardinal Ratzinger, now Benedict XVI, is a man who will be very deliberate in how he approaches things. When he first showed me around the office when I came to work for him, he showed me he had 11 people full-time working at the time. And at that time, it was 1990, he had 3 working computers. And he said, with 3 computers and 11 people, they expect me to create a revolution. And you could tell he's not a revolutionary. His idea is take seriously, prioritize, deal with what's most important first. And right now you see in the first 5 weeks of his pontificate, what he thinks is most important is definitely proclaiming the faith clearly and working towards unity with other Christians. Mm-hmm. He's already reached out to Protestant leaders. And just this weekend, he was reaching out to the Orthodox by his trip to Bari, where the relics of St. Nicholas are. Of course, a great sign of unity between East and West is devotion people have to St. Nicholas.
Well, prior to his election, he gave a famous sermon, edict, what's the word, on the dangers of relativism.
Right. That was part of the homily leading into the conclave. And there, this is one thing that is true about the man, and I think the press in the West has been very good in laying this out. He was a man who saw firsthand in the experience of Germany under Nazism and in the student upheavals of the 60s, plus with what he saw right next door to him with Marxism. He was very concerned that the only bulwark against totalitarianism is truth. He believes that if there is not truth, and that if the truth can't be discerned and discovered, then all that's left is power. And if all that's left is power, the little ones will be crushed. Mm-hmm. And he saw that firsthand. And so he believes strongly that the church is a truth-teaching thing. And the church is a bulwark against totalitarianism because it stands up for the truth about the human person. And so this is something he's very passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees anywhere where we yield on truth, what ends up is that all that's left is power and the little ones are the ones that
are. But isn't it the case that it isn't just Marxism and fascism mm-hmm. that he grew up with, but also other issues that seem to be creating some concern, secularism, liberalism, mm-hmm. modernism, postmodernism. What does he have against these?
Well, actually, he loves a lot of what's happening in the postmodern movement because he feels there's significant errors in modernism mm-hmm. and that what postmodernism is doing is unmasking those errors. He believes that modernism in the version that he's most familiar with, which is the 1789 French Revolution version in Europe, that movement toward enlightenment, while it exalted reason, had an unreasonable belief in the power of reason.
Reason with a capital R.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that there was a need to check reason and recognize there are certain things that are indeed mysteries and beyond our ability to know. This is why he thinks it's important that there's revealed truth mm-hmm. that we can come to know. So he sees in many of the postmoderns, for example, he's been, before he became pope, he had a sponsored a conference where front and center was the works of Catherine Pickstock from England, mm-hmm. Who has shown in her work, part of the radical orthodoxy movement, that there are some significant problems with the twin giants of modernism, which is the scientific method and the human rights movement, if they aren't grounded in something beyond each other.
spiritual.
Yeah, and he would say theology, something.
Well, let's pick up on that, but let me just indicate, if you would like to pose any questions to Monsignor Swetland about these topics or about the election of our new Pope, Benedict the 16th, feel free to call in 333-9455 locally or call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Well, let's talk a little bit more about modernism and secularism. As I understand it, Pope Benedict is, I'm not sure this is the correct expression. Yeah, I'm sure you can correct me on this, but concerned, perplexed by the decline in membership in France, Germany, and other European countries and the rise of secularism in those countries. I have a passage from him, which I'm sure you can document. I don't have it, and correct me if this is not accurate. Someday, says Cardinal Ratzinger, the West will tire of secularism and spiritual loneliness, and they will discover the little community of believers as something quite new, as a hope that is there for them as the answer they have always been looking for.
Yeah. That quotation, which I believe is from Salt of the Earth, he believes that the world without God ends up being joyless. He said, a world that has forgotten God quickly begins to consume itself. Mm-hmm. And in consumption, man is restless and joyless. And I think what he sees is that there's values beyond just satiating our passions. And there's something more than just fulfilling ourselves when it comes to our bodily and physical desires. And so what happens without a belief in a greater than human other is quickly we're bored. We're looking for more and more sensational stimulation. And he thinks that Europe will, if it has not already, begin to find that boredom and tedium just too much. And he's hoping that it will be a chance for the faith to re-evangelize Europe.
Well, let's come back to that. We have a caller. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Your question?
Yes. I wanted to hear some discussion of the removal of this very visible priest. I believe he was Jesuit. He was editor of this Jesuit magazine, America. He was on a lot of the shows commenting on the conclave and the aftermath of that, and he was removed, you know, after he left Rome, which I thought was particularly sort of bizarre that they didn't even tell him while he was there. Something on that, and then there's this case of Maciel Delgolalo. He is apparently the founder in 1942 of Legionnaires of Christ, which is like Opus Dei, only perhaps maybe a little worse. Legionnaires of Christ, there were some members of this in Aznar's war cabinet in Spain, and well, there's a lot being said. You can Google Opus Dei and Ratlines and get some interesting topics of discussion. But the Maciel case, Father Maciel case, is curious in that the investigation of allegations against him of a sexual nature were opened just a couple of months before what looked like the demise of John Paul II, and then just this past week were closed without much comment. And it's sort of these two things. I mean, there are other things that I perceive that have set the tone for this particular pope. But those are particularly unsettling both to American Catholics, I would guess, and anybody interested because of the aspect of this lack of imprimatur for this editor, and then the problem with sexual abuse here in the U.S. So.
Okay, thank you for your call. We have two questions about Father Maciel and also Opus Dei and their implications for Pope Benedict's.
Right. The first one was about Father Tom Rees, who's a Jesuit editor of America magazine. That's what he's making reference to. I don't have any inside information about either of these cases because they're current cases that happened in Rome. In any pontifical transition, there's always things in the works. And from how I understand it, both of these cases that the caller make reference to were things that were in the work before the transition. One was there was a request by the Vatican Curia, and it's not published what part of the Curia requested this, so I can't tell you which part did, that Father Reese be removed as editor of America magazine. America is a very influential magazine, and the published information on this is that there was concern of the approach to America, which was basically an open forum. Very American, no pun intended. The idea was you put up two points of view. And that was the editorial decision that Father Reese had made. Historically, America had been one of the sources of here's official Catholic teaching, here's how we explain it, as the Jesuits would do. Over the years, America changed that to be a journal that would present competing points of view on controversial issues. Mm-hmm. There were those in Rome who felt that was a mistake for a Jesuit journal to have that sort of competing idea. And the thing that I guess irritated a few was the debating questions that some in Rome felt were closed, especially on issues like abortion and things like that. So there was a request that Father Reese be reassigned. That happened recently, but from what I understand was in the works before the transition. If Benedict the 16th was involved with that, there is no hands-on information on that. But again, I'm not saying it isn't him personally. I just don't know. The question of the Legionaries of Christ is a little bit different because there was a report in the press that the case was reopened. This case was actually closed a while ago, and it's on accusations of sexual abuse by the founder of the Legionaries of Christ from the 40s, 50s, and early 60s. One of the problems in that case was the length of gap between now and then in the accusation. Again, I don't have any inside information, but I do know they closed the case. There was a few things that were still open, and that recently led some people to think that the case was still open and even published that it was reopened. But in fact, it never really was reopened. Now, that being said, we would not have handled in America this case the way it was handled in Rome and in Mexico. The accusations came from Mexico. We would have, under the Dallas norms, we would investigated this case.
What are the Dallas norms?
The Dallas norms were the norms of the American bishops adopted at a meeting in Dallas after the revelation of the sexual abuse in Boston that said we were going to investigate every case, that we were not going to use any statutory limits or anything like that to get to the bottom of all these cases so that anyone who was a threat to children would not be in a ministerial position. Rome closed that case, but I will say that the founder of the Legionaries has now retired. He's no longer running the Legionaries of Christ, and they have replaced him with a much younger man, and he's now he's well over 80. I think he's close to 90. So in that sense, you know, the case is seen as closed. We would have handled a difference. Now, as far as the Legionaries of Christ, I can say this openly in our diocese.
For those who don't know what that means, who are they?
They're a religious order that was founded on the model of the Jesuits, but that didn't accept some of the modernization that the Jesuits accepted. We do not have Legionaries of Christ here in the diocese of Peoria. We have problems with some of their methodologies, so we do not have any Legionaries of Christ in the Diocese of Peoria.
Okay. I hope that addressed the caller's questions. Let's get back to this issue of Europe and secularism and liberalism, if we could. Apparently, in this same passage, which you mentioned is from the Salt of the Earth, Cardinal Ratzinger said, maybe we are facing a new and different kind of epoch in the church's history, where Christianity will again be characterized more by the mustard seed, where it will exist in small, seemingly insignificant groups that nonetheless live an intense struggle against evil and bring good into the world that let God in. That sounds to me like he is hearkening back to the Benedictine tradition of sending out small groups to evangelize, and his focus, at least in Europe perhaps, is upon the leaven approach as opposed to the mega church approach. What do you make of that, particularly in Europe and in general? Is this narrowing an otherwise complex theological position that he has?
I think you describe it accurately. I think it's one of the reasons he chose Benedict as his name. Mm-hmm. I think his analysis, you've got to remember he's Augustinian. And I always tell my students that Augustinians are hope-filled pessimists. They're filled of hope because it's a theological virtue. But overall, they're a pessimist. They're pessimistic about the human condition. And a matter of fact, he once commented off the record, but it ended up in print, that he wished that the last document of the Second Vatican Council, which begins the joys and the hopes, the fears and the anguish of modern man, are the hopes and the fears and the hopes and the joys, the fears and the anguish of the church, of the men of the church. He thought it should have been reversed. It should have started with the fears and the anguishes rather than mm-hmm. the hopes and the joys. Mm-hmm. But he really believed that the faith in the middle of the 20th century was a mile wide in Europe, but an inch deep. And therefore, it quickly evaporated when it was confronted with some of the modern ideologies. And he realizes if the faith is going to last, it has to be rooted much deeper. And so the metaphors he uses are biblical, leaven, mustard seed, these images. The idea that Christianity in Europe will be smaller in number, authentic Christians, but they will be more deeply rooted in the faith and therefore may be a better witness to the teaching and values of Christ, especially when it comes to working for social justice.
Why so shallow in Europe?
Because the culture, you could easily go along and just be a cultural Catholic in France or Spain or Italy mm-hmm. or large parts of the...
Nominal Catholic.
And very, very nominal. And not allow that faith to penetrate and possess. Where the faith was under persecution or where the faith was in the minority, there you had... It cost you something to be Catholic. And he feels that that's why the faith so quickly evaporated in the light of consumerism.
Isn't there resistance in European thought in general, French and German and English, resistance to the idea of being possessed by causes, by flags, by great movements because of the traumas of the 20th century?
Well, there's no doubt that one of the great victories of the enemies of Christianity was the religious wars, Europeans have long memories. Mm-hmm. And they know what the religious wars did to Europe in the 16th and 17th century. And they don't ever want to return to that. And so there was and to a large extent you can say that the movement away from religion in the Enlightenment was partly fueled by that. I would say that obviously they don't want to return to that. But now I believe we're at what Cardinal Ratzinger, Benedict XVI calls a turning point for Europe. They have to decide which way they're going to go. Mm-hmm. And this is true on many different levels.
Why is he – do you think he's confident or optimistic about a return to resources, origins within Europe?
I would say there's a tension in all of modern Catholic thought between two movements, aggiornamento, updating, mm-hmm. which the Vatican – Council is very famous for.
Vatican II.
And resourcement, going back to the sources, mm-hmm. patristic, liturgical, and biblical.
One of the great tensions within the church itself for centuries.
Yes. And between those two choices, Cardinal Ratzinger, as an Augustinian, as a man who studied the patristics himself, will always side with resourcement, going back to the sources. Mm-hmm. But not because he wants to go back to some golden era. He knows that's not possible. But he knows there was a time when the church was unified. And his driving passion is to bring Christians into unity again. Mm-hmm. Obviously, as a German, studying St. Augustine was a way for Lutherans and Catholics to agree. Mm-hmm. Because we all agree, Lutheran and Catholic, in the importance of the theological corpus, that is Augustinianism. In his current role as Pope, he's already shown that his first priority, other than tending to the flock that has been placed in his care, is going to be reaching out to other Christian groups, be they Orthodox or Protestant.
This issue of unity of the church has been problematic not just within North America and Europe, but as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, I understand that He gave an edict about the unity of the church, and Asian bishops responded negatively to it, mm-hmm. particularly with respect to his use of the word, other religions are defective. And as so often happens with bishops and local priests, as you're no doubt well aware, they act as a buffer between the hierarchy and the local population. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, certainly. There's a few times that Cardinal Ratzinger, as a theologian and in his position, has stated truths in a way that wasn't intended to be translated or quoted directly, needed to be translated to the local community. I'll give you one, probably light up your switchboard, but his use of the term intrinsically disordered when talking about homosexual orientations.
That comes directly from Augustine, doesn't it?
Right. Well, yeah. and it was a theological, what he believes is a theological truth that explains something, but it was never meant to be used in a pastoral setting. It obviously had to be translated into the individual, you know, on the ground. But he was trying to express theological truths. The problem for us is in America, we want to immediately just take the original quotation, often taken out of context. A lot of people know that quotation of then Cardinal Ratzinger about intrinsic disorder without knowing the context in which it was placed in an entire document.
Apparently that's a widespread problem.
Right.
With many of his passages.
Right. And when he talked about non-Christian religions being defective, what he meant was that there's some important centrality of Christ as the Messiah. The only way to salvation is through Christ. Now, the very same Cardinal Ratzinger who said that when he was a young priest wrote a commentary on the Second Vatican Council's document, Gaudium et Spes, where he says the grace of Christ is offered to every single human person in a way known to God alone.
Even Confucians or Taoists or Shintos who'd never heard of
Jesus. Never heard of Christ or have never effectively heard the gospel. So in his own theological work, he recognizes the grace of Christ working outside of Christian religions. But he still obviously is going to proclaim the centrality of Christ, who in his own teaching says, Jesus says in John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, the life. Mm-hmm. So, I would be honest to say that as a theologian, he sometimes uses language which doesn't translate well pastorally. Mm-hmm. But that's what pastors are supposed to do, is interpret theological language for their flock mm-hmm. in a way that can be understood.
And with the internet, bureaucratic speak gets spread all over the world instantly, and those who are reading it can't distinguish between bureaucratic speak and pastoral speak. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Benedict XVI will never speak in sound bites. And that is to his detriment and to his – I think we should praise him for that. But that is not as meaty savvy as perhaps his predecessor was.
Let me just mention once again, if you'd like to ask questions of Monsignor Father Sweatland about the new Pope, Pope Benedict XVI, please call in locally at 333-9455, or you can call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. You have mentioned Augustine and Augustinianism, two of the great traditions, if not the dominant ones, are Thomism and Augustinianism, and there are, I gather, a number of Thomists who are struggling with Father Ratzinger's ascension. I'm thinking in particular of Charles Curran, who is a theologian in the church, who is concerned that Pope Benedict is overly concerned that too many Catholic theologians in the United States dissent from the church and compromise with a secular ethic that denies the most profound aspect of human nature and leads to new slavery. And Father Curran apparently believes that from a Thomist position, that language doesn't capture what one great strain of thought within the church itself ought to be tolerated as a gray area as opposed to final authority. What is your view on that?
Well, there's, I think, two questions there, one on Father Curran and his position, but one about this quotation from Benedict XVI about the new slavery. I think it's a profound statement and a bold one, and I think to some extent a courageous one, because if you look at how he uses it, he believes that if we give in to materialism and consumerism, we're enslaving ourselves. to a world that ultimately is lacks hope and joy and peace. But he also believes that to be able to consume, like the first world is consuming, that we, our economic system, imposes a new slavery on a good chunk of the rest of the world, so that we can continue to live the lifestyle we do. So when he uses new slavery, there's a double entendre there, that we are enslaving ourselves to consumerism, materialism, and in the process, enslaving much of the world to work in sweatshops and to have...
The numbers are staggering. 1/6 of the world's population uses 90% of the resources, and on and on and on.
Right. So I believe it's a very courageous statement upon Benedict XVI to call this what it is, an enslavement. It may not be that they're actually
just economic. It's not just spiritual.
Right. It's economic. Now the first world is being spiritually enslaved, and in the process, they're physically or economically enslaving a good chunk of the rest of the world. So that I think is a courageous statement. Now, what Father Curran is criticizing is his lack of embracing a certain version of Thomism that Father Curran embraces, which would see much of the sexual teaching of the Church being open to change. And, of course, in the 80s, he disciplined Father Curran in his former job as prefect for the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith. And though Father Curran has criticized him heavily for that, he also thanked him recently because it meant all of his books sold a lot more, and he became much more famous than Father he ever would have been.
Father Curran has said on two or three occasions that this controversy has made him more influential in the American church than ever.
That is correct. I think a lot more people read his works than ever would have. I was at Catholic U when Father Curran was asked to step down from his theological chair because Rome had decided that he was not authentically presenting Catholic faith. They offered him a chair in religious studies, but he refused to take that and went to Southern Methodist. And if you look at Father Curran's totality of his read, I love to read him. He's a good theologian. He teaches a lot, but I think there are some real problems in his approach.
Namely?
Well, proportionalism. The idea that the way that you find moral truth is through the summing up of the what he calls premoral goods versus premoral evils. And it's a form of utilitarianism, though he would disagree with that. And my problem with it is it doesn't leave room for there to be moral absolutes, which I think there are. I think it's always wrong to sleep with someone who isn't your spouse. I think it's always wrong to kill the innocent. Father Curran would say, well, it's usually wrong, but there may be some occasions when it's appropriate.
One last call, if you'd like to call in to talk to Monsignor Father Swetlin about Pope Benedict XVI and his... influence on the church today, the Catholic Church, call 333-9455, 333-9455, or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Well, back to this tension between Augustinianism and Thomism. Is there any room for Thomist in the church?
Almost certainly. Well, John Paul II was a Thomist, though he adopted modern philosophical approaches, personalism and phenomenology. He also brought his own metaphysics, which was classically rooted in the Thomistic approach. And much of Cardinal Ratzinger's own work has Thomistic undertones. He's not so Augustinian that he rejects everything that comes after Augustine. And Thomas himself used Augustine greatly. Now, he used other sources as well. I think the difference really is more of tone than of substance. Thomas's anthropology is much more optimistic about how grace can penetrate, possess, and perfect the person even here and now. St. Augustine's much more negative on human nature and its ability of being perfected by grace here and now. To some extent, that's a matter of tone and emphasis. They both are Catholic doctors of the Church. They both present the faith, I think, in compelling ways. Obviously, the modern world's not going to be convinced by either of them because they're men of their own eras. And we have to adapt the teaching of the Church, which comes to us from Christ, to this era. And I think a lot of what you'll see in Benedict XVI is an attempt to do that, is to explain the faith to the modern world. Now, he's not going to try to prove things. That's not his job as Pope. His job is proclamation. It's up to theologians to try to do apologetics and proof and reflection on this. As Pope, his main job will be to proclaim these truths. It will be up to the faithful, including the theological world, to explain these truths.
There's some talk about his background in Germany as a child. Apparently he was in the Hitler Youth, and there's a lot of stuff going around about that. What do you know about that biography?
I know what's in the standard biographies on this and what he has said himself. It's not something I spoke to with him about personally.
He has written about it.
Right, he has written about it. And everybody in his day and age, at his age, when he was 12 and 13,
they had to be... I think he was 16 when he ran away.
Right.
When Hitler died.
He had just turned 17. And what happened was he was in seminary. And they closed the seminary. He was in seminary at 12.
Oh.
He and his older brother, George. And they closed the seminary. And that made them open to the draft. Now,
where in Germany, by the way?
This was in Bavaria.
Bavaria.
Yeah. And this made them open to the draft. They had a pre-draft where they would do not be in the front lines, but be serving. And he did serve for a couple of for almost a year and a half in that capacity, where he was involved with an anti-aircraft gun. He never fired. He never was involved there. But he had to be in that period in the Hitler Youth technically. But he had a friendly teacher who signed him up, but exempted him from actually coming to everything.
Something about he was a helper, not a gunner.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then after he turned old enough to actually be drafted, he was drafted. He was sent towards what was the Eastern Front, but things were collapsing at that stage. And eventually he was sent home, again, never being involved, he and his brother both. And even at home, they kept trying to march them around for propaganda purposes, and he couldn't take that, so he did desert in the last few months of the war. He was when the Americans took charge, he was arrested as someone who had been in the service and was in an American POW camp for a couple of months, but was quickly repatriated and then back into the seminary. Mm-hmm. So he obviously was pretty, as you read his writings on this, pretty disgusted with the whole period, because he saw what ideology does to truth.
I bring that up because I'm wondering if his development as a young man, theologically and otherwise morally, wasn't very much influenced by his personal firsthand brush with fascism and all that it meant, and clearly a negative view of human nature. Augustinian tradition would seem to be compatible with that. In the United States, where there is not that history, liberalism, and I'd like to focus on this if I could, seems to have a more receptive soil to grow in. To what extent is he unable to appreciate liberalism, or do you think he fully understands liberalism in the United States, whatever that means? Liberalism insofar as it emerges out of the Enlightenment, emerges in political resistance to dictatorial domination, and the optimism and progressivism that grew up in this country around it. There's a certain passion about that strikes me as a genuine issue here.
There's no doubt in my mind that he chose Augustinian to study St. Augustine and became an Augustinian, partly because of his desire for unity between Lutherans and Catholics. Mm-hmm. I think that was his first motivation. But I think it would be naive to believe that not on a subconscious level or just below the surface, he also saw the depravity of man, and that led him, that much of the texts of Augustine who speak to that in his discussions about free will and the passions.
Not that we didn't have a little bit of depravity of man in the United States with slavery and so on.
And I think that just resonated with him. But when it comes to liberalism, and this is where the neoconservatives criticize him a little for interpreting 1776 through the lens of 1789. The neoconservatives
Translate that a little.
Well, our revolution, many Europeans look at the American Revolution as just another form of the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. I think they're very different revolutions with a very different agenda. And proof of this is that religious belief always was an important part of the American culture, where to a large extent the Enlightenment Project in France was a rejection of religion.
After all, there was a statue erected to reason
in Notre Dame, the cathedral in Paris. So the desecration of that cathedral and the rejection of religion in the French. So to some extent, I don't know if Cardinal Ratzinger sees a distinction between the two revolutions the way that many Americans would wish people would see that distinction. And in that sense, if he thinks of liberalism through the lens of the Enlightenment project in France and its effect in Europe and the Napoleonic Wars, et cetera, it leaves him with a more jaundiced view of it. I think he looks to America and sees this incredible religiosity, which is so peculiar.
Well over 90%.
Well over 90%. But at the same time, he looks to us and sees our being the leading cause of the consumerism and materialism that we spoke about earlier, seeing this new slavery at work in a huge way. For example, I said this last time I was on the show, but it just amazes me to know that the American pastime now is pornography. The receipts for pornography in America now outstrip all professional sports combined. Mm-hmm. And so you look at that and you see a tremendous engine of as far as we're concerned, an enslavement that the human person is going through. And so I think he has a very very much he looks at America as it being very paradoxical.
He's not the only one. Many Muslims throughout the world have the same mm-hmm. reaction when they watch American television spread mm-hmm. all over the world. Mm-hmm. What do you think he thinks liberalism is in America?
Well, I think he believes that liberalism in its pure form presents to humanity that we will overcome the results of the fall through technological advancement and the satiation of all human needs through our own technology, our own ingenuity. Mm-hmm. And while, of course, we want to see advancements in medicine and science and in the marketplace and people being wealthier, et cetera, the idea that we can overcome all of the results of the fall that way is dangerous.
He thinks that of liberalism?
Yes, I think that's what he believes.
Is that fair, do you think?
He looks back. If you look at his philosophical and theological works on this, he looks back to Vico in Italy right. and Bacon in England as being a fundamental shift where we went away from the perfection of man through grace.
Auguste Comte.
Right, and the perfection of man through the virtues to the idea that we will perfect man through
science and technology,
the new Atlantis, mm-hmm. the idea that we will have the new Garden of Eden will be brought about by our own technological advance. And of course, the perfect example of this is ongoing work on the human genome and the idea of perfecting humans in our genetic mm-hmm. manipulations. He looks at that as
attitudes towards death and dying, abortion, euthanasia.
The whole works. And he looks at that as hubris, as man's pride. Again, like Tower of Babel, trying to build ourselves up to God. Mm-hmm. Christians believe, and he emphasizes this heavily in his writings, that the only way we can become godlike is through receptivity, through receiving as gift the grace of God that allows us to become the adopted children of God.
So there's no possibility through public, democratic, rational discourse that a liberal democratic society can come up with an ethic for business ethics or healthcare ethics or other forms of ethics in the absence of theological enlightenment?
He would say that everything can't be up for a vote. For example, who counts in our society can't be up for a vote. We can't say that some humans get to count and some don't. That has to be something we receive. So the question of who are human beings and who aren't is an important truth that we should receive. So that he's very much in that sense, he believes in the liberal democratic process as a good process, the best we've come up with. Mm-hmm. He would not make it an idol. He would say it's got its flaws too. But his argument would be that not everything can be up for a vote. Moral truth, he would say, can't be up for a vote. We have to receive it. But of course, our founding says the same things. We hold certain truths to be self-evident.
And the Bill of Rights. So I'm just a little perplexed that liberalism is necessarily reduced to 51% consensus. I'm not sure that's true. The Bill of Rights mm-hmm. and principle democracy and all the work on that suggest otherwise, that right. there are many secularists would argue that there are ways to come up with checks on abuse of fundamental moral principles, independently of theological or other foundations. So how does he think about that? He's clearly a well-informed and articulate theologian.
I would just give one example.
Just to clarify, it seems to me from what I've read, that's really the nexus of the issue for liberal theologians and secularists, mm-hmm. liberal secularists, and trying to come to terms with who Pope Benedict is in the world today.
I would say one of the fundamental disagreements between Benedict XVI and the American Project as it's currently interpreted would be over what Justice Kennedy said in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that the fundamental right to privacy is the right to define your own meaning of existence. Cardinal Ratzinger would say, Benedict XVI would say, no, humans don't get to define their own meaning of existence. Mm-hmm. Their meaning of existence is written already. Mm-hmm. They were created in the image and likeness of God. They're called to a divine communion with God. They have a purpose and meaning that is already not something we invent, it's something we discover. Mm-hmm. He would say that's fundamentally, if that's what our society is built on, the right to discover or to live by your own meaning and purpose of existence, then it's flying in the face of the fact that we don't create reality, we discover reality. Mm-hmm. So there would be a fundamental disagreement at the core. Now, I don't believe that Planned Parenthood versus Casey was rightly defined, and I don't think that mega right is to be found in our constitutional system. I think it's invented by Holdcroft and is a danger to everything our constitutional system believes because it denies that there are truths that everyone can agree upon. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a democracy can survive as a relativist democracy. There has to be absolutes.
Right. Well, let's just change tack just a little bit. Across the world, there's a resurgence of focus on the spiritual side of life. Some argue that this is in response to materialism, secularism, consumerism, and so on. And this isn't just within the Protestant tradition. It's also the Muslim tradition as well. There are some folks who are suggesting that the rise of fundamentalism, which carries with it a whole lot of negative baggage, but let me just go ahead and use the word and you can deconstruct it however you want. Would you say that the rise of fundamentalism across the world is reflected in the fact that Cardinal Ratzinger was elected so swiftly? How many votes were there?
Fourth vote. Right.
It's one of the swiftest.
Yes.
In history. How do you understand that within the church, in the context of these larger movements, not just within Catholicism, but Protestantism and fundamentalism and Hinduism as well?
Right. Well, I believe that fundamentalism, and here I follow really the great work of Martin Marty. Mm-hmm. who has done a four-volume study of this. But I think fundamentalism grows wherever it is a reactionary movement. It's a reactionary movement to the denial of certain truths, theological or moral. And it's an example where one extreme leads to the other. And I think it's a real it's something that we have to counteract in our society. Because it does.
You say it is pathological?
No, I don't think it's pathological. I think, and this is one thing that now I'll speak for Benedict XVI. Benedict XVI sees why it's happening. He sees, for example, why parts of Islam is reacting to the West.
So he would not agree to being categorized as a fundamentalist within
most certainly not. Most certainly not.
There are those, right?
Right. There are some that would like to categorize him that way, and I think that's a very unfair reaction. And if you read. If you read the corpus of work on fundamentalism, the definition would not include where Benedict XVI is. But it is a natural outgrowth of the rejection of everything that society has had accepted to be fundamentally true. And what Benedict would say, I understand why Islam is doing what Islam is doing. What he would argue is, and he says there's much truth in what Islam is trying to put forward and trying to critique the West. What he would argue against is the imposition of belief. And any place where we try to impose belief on people.
Which you associate with fundamentalism.
Right.
A coercive feature.
It's the idea that these truths, be they theological or moral, would be imposed upon people without people's freedom being able to exercise them. Now, obviously, some moral truths have to be that way. We have murder laws, after all. But the fundamentalists, for example, growing up, I lived in a society, in a town where all the stores had to be closed on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a nice imposition of Christian view. Other people's holy days are not Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't take into consideration that, you know, their holy days were different days.
Mm-hmm. Friday, Saturday, right. Sunday. Before we get too close to the end, let me just mention that the University YMCA, of which Dr. Shoemaker is a director, is continuing its Dump and Run program. The Dump and Run program is for those of you who wish to leave various items from a move that you might make with the Y for resale or use in various different ways. They do not accept sleeper sofas, large appliances, stoves, washers, dryers, non-working electronics, or large exercise equipment, but other items they will. The Dump and Run program continues from Saturday, 9 to 4 p.m. until June 4th, and Monday through Friday until June 9th from 9 to 4 p.m. And then later in August, they will start up again. So please take advantage of the YWCA's Dump and Run program. If you have any questions about it, contact Rachel at 337-1500. Well, why don't we wind this up with a little bit about how you see the Newman Foundation in light of all the changes within the church. What's going on in the Newman Foundation these days?
I was very a little bit surprised and very impressed with how excited the students were in dealing with the change. Of course, all of them only had grown up and only seen one pope, John Paul II. And there was a great outpouring.
How many years? 20?
He was elected in 78. So we were in our 27th year,
right,
of his pontificate. And there was a great outpouring of love and a great interest in reviewing and understanding better his contribution intellectually, pastorally, to the church and to the world. And then I thought that would sort of peter out and there would not be much interest in the new pope. But even more so with the election of Benedict XVI, the students were excited, are reading, a lot of them this summer are reading his works and are studying and are interested in following the early homilies that he gave. It was surprising how many of them were sending them around on the internet to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's actually been a time where the students have become even more excited about their faith,
right,
which is a good thing.
Well, Father Monsignor Stuart W. Sweatland, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been an honor. Thank you.
For the fifth or sixth time, we're not sure, right?
Right.
Thank you very much. It was a very stimulating conversation. We've been talking with Father Monsignor Stuart Sweatland, who is chaplain of St. John's Catholic Chapel, director of the Newman Foundation, and director of campus ministries for the Diocese of Peoria. This is Don Nolan. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Ask any babbling baby. Talking's fun. At least it is until the grammarians get after you. But Patricia O'Connor says we can all relax.
There's nothing wrong with splitting an infinitive, and there never was. There's never been any grammatical foundation for that belief.
I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on the Peabody Award-winning program, To the Best of Our Knowledge, we take on the rules of grammar. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. Programming on WILL is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASC-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake and suspension work, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. The phone number for TK Service is 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with scattered showers and isolated thunderstorms. The low in the mid-50s with light and variable winds. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers in the morning, then partly sunny in the afternoon. The high in the mid-70s with northeast winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s and northeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.